episode 25.
Welcome to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast with Jacob Ayers, providing actionable content to help you along your journey to financial freedom through real estate investing. As the premier asset class, real estate has helped ordinary people just like you amass fortunes. The benefits of passive income from real estate investing will allow you to live a life you want. And now, your host, entrepreneur, real estate investor, and apartment deal syndicator, Jacob Ayers.
Hi, and welcome to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast, episode 25. I'm your host, Jacob Ayers. Today, our guest is Brian Burke. Brian is the president and CEO of Praxis Capital, a vertically integrated real estate private equity investment firm. Praxis currently manages a portfolio of active funds for the acquisition of multifamily and single-family residential assets nationwide. Over the course of a real estate investment career that began in 1989, the funds Brian manages have acquired over 700 properties, including over 1,000 multifamily units, using the assistance of proprietary software that he wrote himself. Acquired asset classes include single-family homes, self-storage, mixed-use, and large apartment complexes in multiple states. Praxis's current portfolio exceeds $100 million of real estate assets under management. As a recognized expert, Brian has been a frequent speaker at real estate forums and conferences, including the Opal Family Office and Private Wealth Management Forum, the Kiritsu Real Estate Forum, and the Institute for Private Investors. He has also served as the co-host and real estate expert on Fox News radio show, The Best of Investing. Brian is married and has lived in Northern California for over 30 years. An avid aviation enthusiast, he is a licensed instrument-rated airplane and helicopter pilot. Today, I'm excited to bring on the show, Brian. Brian, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm great, Jacob. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brian, could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you got started investing in real estate?
Well, yeah, I got started investing in real estate at a pretty young age. I was 20 years old, and I just thought that there had to be a better way to make money than to just trade time for a paycheck. So I was looking at, you know, a variety of different things and tried a bunch of different stuff, but ultimately I just felt real estate had the most opportunity. So I gave it a shot. I bought my first property when I was 20 years old. It was a rental. I didn't even own the house I lived in. And it wasn't the greatest experience, quite frankly, as I think a lot of people could find when they're just getting started in something. You don't know what you're doing, it can be tough. But I learned a lot of great lessons and enough to make me want to do it again. And 700 and something properties later, I'm still doing it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you got started at a really young age, which is really fortunate for yourself. When you were 20 years old looking at, you know, the world in front of you, what kind of made you lean towards real estate investing, having no experience in anything?
Well, I had seen these foreclosure notices in the newspaper, and it looked interesting to me that I thought, well, you know, this might be an opportunity or a way to acquire real estate at a discount. And I recall that, you know, when my parents were going through financial difficulty, their house was in foreclosure. And I remember getting a foreclosure notice on our door, and I kind of knew a little bit about it because I'd been through it from that side. And when I saw the foreclosure notice in the newspaper, I thought, I gotta research this a little further, and started researching it and realized that this was just there was a real business opportunity here. And I'm glad I did, because I'd say that out of over 700 that I've done, probably over 675 of those have been through foreclosure in some way or another.
Okay, wow. So that's certainly your avenue for finding deals and developing leads is through foreclosures, it sounds.
It was. In the single family side, that's definitely been a mode for us. It's been foreclosure. We've done, you know, our multifamily business is our primary focus now as we've grown. Obviously, we've grown out of single family primarily, and we're now in the multifamily space. And we've gotten a few multifamily properties as a result of foreclosure, whether you know, they were bank owned or in the process of going through a receivership one way or the other. Not so much anymore. We aren't finding those nowadays as often, but certainly a few years back, it was a good source of leads for multifamily.
Yeah, good. So we could talk. Could we talk a little bit about your investing strategy and how you've transitioned from single families to multifamilies, and why exactly?
Well, when the market collapsed in 2008, I grew a business of flipping, you know, a couple dozen houses a year into a business of flipping over 100 houses a year. And it grew pretty large. We had a pretty sizable organization here. We were raising money from investors to acquire all these houses. And it was a great business, but we knew that it was a limited lifespan opportunity. And once the foreclosure crisis of the Great Recession worked its way through, the single family foreclosure opportunity was gonna, you know, go by the wayside along with it. So we were looking at what could we do that had a longer runway, and multifamily to me seemed to be the route to go. I'd already had some experience in multifamily on a smaller scale when I did 1031 exchange into some multifamily. So it wasn't really a new business to me. It was one that I'd had a little bit of experience with on a personal level. But I knew that for us to grow the business, you know, when you're doing 100 houses a year, that's a high bar to grow from. And the only way to grow from that is really large scale. And the only way to get scale in real estate is in commercial property. So we started buying apartments in 2008, you know, the larger apartments in 2008 after the Great Recession. And we just started growing it from there.
Yeah, so it sounds like your transition into multifamily was kind of based on the rebound of the economy and the housing market, really not being able to scale much larger than you were at the time. That's a really large size business of flipping 100 homes a year. Sounds like a phenomenal amount of work and a lot of time and effort involved looking for those deals. So
it was, and we're doing this in the San Francisco Bay Area, so these aren't cheap houses. So it was a real capital intensive business. So, you know, you're doing you know, tens of millions of dollars a year in volume to grow that, you know, you need to do that with larger commercial properties. You can't really grow that scale in single family. I don't think you'd really want to. So for us, it was a matter of, you know, finding that avenue to continue to grow our business and satisfy our investors' appetite for quality real estate investments.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned investors there, because sounds like you've put together a fund in the past and you invest through this fund. So could you talk a little bit about the process of how acquiring that fund works and when you deploy that capital and when it's sitting idle and some of those kind of nuances?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple ways to do this. One is to invest through a fund, and the other is to raise money for each asset as you're acquiring it. And these are two specifically distinct strategies on acquiring real estate with investors' money. The very first way I did this was through a fund. When I first got started, I was working a full-time job, and I left that job and went to my former coworkers and told them all about what I was doing with real estate investing and asked if they wanted to invest. And they all did. I ended up raising a little over $500,000 that I put in a fund that I had complete discretion over, and this was almost 20 years ago. So it's been long enough now where that actually used to get you something. 500 grand doesn't get you much these days. But it was a vehicle that I could use to acquire any real estate that I felt was appropriate. And so that's how a fund works. And the idle capital was just there to use as opportunities arose. And we would take that money to the foreclosure auction. We would bid on auctions and buy the houses. And to the extent that money was idle, it wasn't obviously earning much, so we wanted to keep it busy all the time. The other way of investing is where you raise money for a specific deal, which on the smaller scale, like with single family, it's difficult to do because there's a lot of transactions. You know, you're not raising a lot of money for each property. It's a small amount. The paperwork required and attorney time and so on to develop offering documents just doesn't really fit well with the small size of single family houses. So for large commercial projects, what we do is we raise money on a deal by deal basis rather than on a fund basis. It avoids us having all that idle capital sitting there and having to feel the pressure of needing to deploy that capital and make bad investments.
Yeah, right. So it kind of comes down to the scalability when you're looking at a fund versus raising money for one deal. Like you said, it doesn't really make sense to raise money for one deal in a single family house. But when you get into larger magnitude, larger size properties and multifamily, that's when it kind of crosses that threshold and becomes worth the time and effort.
Yeah, I mean, we'll spend, you know, 10 to 20K in legal fees to put together offering documents for an offering. That doesn't work if you're trying to raise $50,000 for a single family investment.
It really kills your margin.
Yeah, just a little.
Yeah. So when you've got the fund of idle capital, you're really trying to act as quickly and actively as possible to deploy that, right?
Because that's the risk of a fund, right? I mean, you know, you've got money sitting there and it's not earning a return for your investors. So it puts you in this position where you feel you've got pressure to go and deploy it by buying things. So that's what I really prefer investing on a one-off basis, because when we do that, we can be patient. If there's no deals to be found, we do no deals. There's no stress. There's no pressure. We don't have a pref clock ticking where we're saying, okay, we're paying our investors an 8% preferred return. So every day that goes by, that's X amount of dollars that are being allocated to the investors that, you know, we're under pressure to deploy. So I don't like doing the fund. You know, we may get there again someday when our deal flow is such that, you know, it makes more sense. You know, right now we've got $42 million of real estate in contract, so it might actually make sense for us to have a fund right now, but we could go six more months before we find another one. And, you know, that would be idle capital sitting there during that period of time. So I'm just not ready to take that risk.
Yeah, it sounds like you have to worry about the feast famine kind of dilemma when operating a fund.
You do, yes.
All right, Brian, so could you kind of talk a little bit about the projects you have going on right now, what your portfolio is looking like?
Well, we got a few different things. So on the single family side, what we're doing now is we're selling all the rental houses that we bought at the bottom of the market. I think it's a great time to be exiting out of single family rentals. I think it's a difficult time to be buying single family rentals, at least in, you know, Northern California and San Francisco Bay Area. Other areas may be seeing a different markets than we are, but for where we're at here, we're sellers. On the multifamily side, we're buyers. You know, there are some that will say the market's getting late in the cycle, and to the extent I do agree to that, you know, there's a risk there's going to be an adverse market cycle at some point, but we're underwriting to that assumption that that's actually going to happen. So we're really active on the multifamily side. We're buying. Our portfolio just crossed over $100 million about 6 months ago. It'll be over $150 million within the next 90 days. And, you know, we've grown to over 1,000 multifamily units that we're currently just in our, you know, in our hold phase. And then we've got 606 units that we're acquiring right now.
Wow, that sounds awesome. So are you focusing mostly in the Bay Area still in Northern California?
Oh, heck no. There's no reason to be investing in real estate in California.
That's what I was wondering.
No, absolutely not. In fact, you know, we've got one property in contract in Florida, one in Georgia, and one in Arizona right now.
Okay. So predominantly in the South, then, you could say.
Predominantly, yeah. Historically, we've been centered in Texas has been our primary stomping ground, and most of the assets that we've had on the multifamily side have been in Texas. But, you know, there's even markets in Texas now that are starting to get a little overheated. I don't know if anybody's tried looking at Dallas lately, but the, you know, pricing there is just starting to get a little bit crazy. So we started looking in other areas. Our, you know, our team has a lot of experience all over the country, so we're leveraging that experience. You know, I've got guys here in our shop that, you know, we've got 90,000 units of multifamily experience in probably 40 out of the 50 states. So what we're doing now is we're just leveraging that experience and that track record to go and acquire properties, you know, with pretty much without any geographical boundaries, although we are predominantly focusing on the southeastern U.S.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So you're selling all your single family homes essentially and trying to transition to multifamily properties. Now, let me ask you, is it difficult or possible to 1031 out of your single family fund properties and then into a multifamily property?
Well, certainly it could be done. It's a little challenging, especially when you're doing a multiple single family into a multifamily. It's challenging because of the timing of all the closings. And so, you know, in our single family portfolio, we had over 100 homes in California in our single family portfolio. So certainly it would make no sense to try to sell all 100 of those houses all at once in 1031 exchange into a commercial property. And that also being said, you know, our business of raising capital from investors, those investors all have different goals. When we acquired the single family homes, we told them this was a 5-year strategy. The 5 years is coming up. So, you know, it's time to cycle out of that. In order to do a 1031 exchange, all of those investors would have to be on board with staying in the fund, going into the next exchange property and staying in there. So it's just unlikely that that's going to happen. You're going to have full agreement all the way across the board that everybody wants to do that. And if you don't, while there's ways around it, they're pretty complicated and tricky and, you know, full of snake holes. So it's just better to, you know, just cut loose, pay the tax, reinvest the money in the next opportunity without the stress of a 45-day 1031 clock ticking and all the timing of all the closings of all those homes.
Yeah, right. A lot of things have to line up just perfectly. So correct me if I'm wrong, but say if you have two people that own a single family home and you want to sell that home and 1031 exchange into, say, a multifamily, both of those owners have to roll their equity into the multifamily, right? You can't just one person go there about their business and one person continue to 1031.
Well, I think that a lot of that depends on how they hold title and if they're tenant in common interest. You know, perhaps they could 1031 exchange each of their half interests into something different. But what they would need to do, anybody considering doing something like that really needs to talk to a 1031 exchange expert that does this every day and can, you know, give them guidance on the nuances, because the laws are very specific on how you have to do that. And I'm no 1031 exchange expert. I've done a couple, but in our business, it's a real rare event. When you're raising capital from investors into funds or into single asset allocations with multiple investors, 1031 exchanges are a pretty rare tool to use.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. Okay, Brian, could you talk about some of your best and worst deals you've had to date?
Oh man, I've had my share of both, you know, and it's kind of a moving target. You know, we get a great deal. I think that's the best deal I'm ever going to do. And you get another one where you're like, that's the best deal we've ever done. So, you know, we've done a lot of really good ones. I was just telling somebody in my office the other day, they were asking about our single family fund on our rental pool. And I was mentioning how difficult it was to raise capital to buy single family homes back in 2010, when, you know, everybody still thought the market was falling and, you know, we were trying to raise capital. We were telling people, look, the market's going to double in 5 years. And people said, you're crazy. That's never going to happen. We're not investing in this. The market's still going down. It's, you know, so we struggled to raise capital for that. I mean, we still end up raising enough to buy, you know, $40 million worth of real estate, but it was, I mean, we could have done five times that if we could have gotten enough investors. But I was telling this story to one of the guy in my office the other day, and we had just recently sold one of the houses in that rental fund. And I said, you know, we bought this house for like $120,000 or somewhere around there. We didn't even do anything to the house. It just, you know, the old owner that lost it in foreclosure, we rented it to them. So they didn't even move out. They paid rent, lived there for a few years. They moved out. We put a tenant in. The house didn't really need anything. We rented it out for a couple more years. And then they moved out, so we sold it without even fixing it up, and we sold it for like $450,000.
Wow!
And it's like, so, you know, there's a $300,000 spread in this house that we paid $150,000 for. And I said, and, you know, the funny part about it is we got a loan on it, so we probably only had $30,000 or $40,000 in cash tied up. And so, you know, the IRR on that deal is just through the roof. And it just makes me laugh when I think back to all the people that said that was a bad deal to invest in that fund. So, you know, on the single family side, I think that was a pretty good deal.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And then, you know, on the multifamily side, we've had our share of really good deals. You know, we did an apartment complex down in Austin, Texas, where, you know, we cycled out of it in 21 months by beating our 5-year projection in 18 months. We were out in 21. We got 42% internal rate of return to our investors, which blew away all of our projections. I think that was another big win. And, you know, and we've had a number of other real significant wins on the multifamily side since. And I think that's what makes this business so much fun.
Well, it's certainly easy to keep those investors coming back when you're getting those 42% IRRs.
Yeah, you know, they come with the downsides too. You know, real estate isn't always just, you know, rainbows and unicorns. You know, we've had deals where they haven't gone the right way. In fact, I did one, my worst deal ever, in my opinion, was one that we bought right after the real estate collapse, but before the economic collapse, because there were kind of two crashes. It was like 07 when real estate tanked, and then it was 2009-ish when, you know, Bear Stearns and all that, and, you know, the great financial collapse, which caused all the economic calamity. So we bought this apartment complex in Texas in 2008. It was after the real estate collapse, so we paid half of what the guy before me paid, which I thought that meant I was a genius, and we got a great deal. But then, you know, we fixed it up. We got it all the way to 100% occupied, and that lasted for like a week. And then the great economic collapse happened. And, you know, when that happened, it's, you know, people were losing their jobs, and people were moving out of their apartments and doubling up with family. And, you know, I used to joke and say that, you know, basically, you know, half the apartments are empty and the other half aren't paying. and that was kind of what it was like. And, you know, this property was, it got to the point where the income dropped so low, there was only just enough money to pay all the property's expenses, but not enough money to pay the debt service on the loan. So I ended up paying the debt service on the loan, which was 15 grand a month. I paid that out of my own pocket for like 3 years while I waited for the economy to come back. And then when the economy finally came back, then, you know, the property started cash flowing again and so on. And ultimately, we ended up selling that property. I got all the money back I loaned in to keep the thing afloat. The investors got all their money back. We all even earned a return. It was like 2% IRR. So I guess that balances off the 42 we got on the other deal. But, you know, some of these things just don't go right. But, you know, that was a tough, tough one. And I never want to repeat that.
Yeah, how'd you handle that with your investors when you were going through that 3-year dry spell of floating the mortgage yourself?
Well, you know, I kept them informed on everything that was happening. You know, we would share, you know, results on a routine basis to show where the occupancy was and what we were trying to do to increase it, and what was going on with collections and what we were trying to do to increase that. And, you know, we were making a tremendous effort, you know, constant calls with property management on trying to find ideas on how we could turn it around. But, you know, you can't fight the current sometimes. And the economy was so bad that it was beyond our ability to control. So all we could do is keep the investors informed. Certainly they really appreciated the fact that I was putting about 15K a month to keep the thing afloat so they weren't losing their investment. And, you know, by the time we finally sold, it was kind of fun to write the investors that check to give them their money back plus their return, because a few of them had said, gosh, you know, I wrote this money off years ago thinking we were never going to see it again. I can't believe we're actually getting this money back. And, you know, I told them, I said, I've been doing this for, you know, 25 years. I've never lost an investor's principal, and I'm not about to start now.
Yeah, well, way to turn a bad scenario into a good outcome.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
So, Brian, you've done over 700 deals. At one point, you were flipping over 100 homes a year. Get over $100 million in asset. So I'm assuming you've really built a strong team around you. Could you talk about how you've built that team and what that team looks like?
Yeah, it's a moving target, actually. It's interesting. You'd think that, you know, these teams are like where you got this office with, you know, 50 people running around, and it isn't really like that. We grew this to about 25 employees when we were at the peak of doing 100 and something houses a year. And a lot of that staff was internal construction guys, where we ended up hiring our own tradespeople and so on. So that was a large part of our staff. But, you know, to build a team, I mean, it starts out with the minuscule. I mean, the first thing you got to do is find an agent that can find you property. You know, then you're building to finding a property manager to manage it. You're looking for attorneys to help you draft your paperwork, accountants to help you sort out, you know, the financial results and get the taxes done and that sort of thing. So that was just a really slow process that was built over time while we were still really small in scale, just doing a few houses a year. And you just add those team members one at a time by just asking for referrals and word of mouth and so on. And then, as you grow, I had to learn how to build teams out of the area. So that started with the first foray was buying houses in a neighboring county. And now I got to find an agent in that county and a property manager in that county. And then it was two counties away and doing the same thing. And then it was, three states away. And doing the same thing again. So really, it's just about networking and finding those team members. And then, internally, we've got just a few people here in the accounting side. I have a senior vice president of investor relations that talks to the investors and helps get them subscribed to our investments. And then we just started a property management company so that we can vertically integrate our own property management. Now that's where the business is going to grow fairly large. We're going to be adding a lot of team members to facilitate that. But, building a real estate team is just, it's a one person at a time, one role at a time, is the only way you can do it successfully.
Yeah. Right. So can we talk about your property management team that you're building? So that sounds like every market you have property, you're going to have employees there running those properties for you.
That's right.
Okay. And so, those are going to be spread across the U.S., a lot of people to manage. But like you said, vertically integrated, you're going to have some synergies there and have, a relationship in every one of your markets.
Yeah, you get more control that way. Historically, we've done third-party management where we would hire a property management company. They would oversee the employees on site. They would hire the employees. They supervise the employees. And our job is to supervise the property managers. And that works great until you get to a specific scale. And, now that we're starting to get institutional investors that are investing with us, they want to see that you're managing yourself so that you have ultimate control over the employees and the real estate without a third party being involved. So in order for us to vertically integrate successfully, I've brought in a great team, and the CEO of our management company has 40 years of multifamily management experience, has managed over 37,000 units in probably 40 states. So he's in charge of building the property management company and hiring those the staff at the property, overseeing the staff at the property and that sort of thing. And then, we're building out a whole organizational chart on that side with a chief operating officer, a controller. That's where the business gets pretty large because there's a lot of pieces to manage.
Yeah, sounds awesome. So what are both your personal goals and the goals of Prax Capital moving forward?
Well, my personal goal is really to just continue building what we've accomplished so far. We've just, like I said earlier, we crossed 1,000 units in our portfolio. We're going to be at 2,000 units fairly soon. Our goal is to get to 10 to 20,000 units. And to do that within the next 4 to 5 years. So, it's about ramping up our acquisitions platform, building our investor base even deeper, and just kind of, growing by continuing to grow as we have by word of mouth and referrals.
Yeah, great. And how about, I guess the goals are fairly aligned with both your personal ones and Prax Capital.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of times you hear people say that they get into real estate because they want to go travel and they want time off. They want to work part-time and all that other stuff. Well, that might work fine if you're just going to buy a few properties, but when you get to a certain scale, this is more than a full-time job. This is a business just like any other business, and that's how we treat it. So, my personal goals and the business goals are pretty well aligned because one doesn't do anything without the other.
Right. So Brian, you have some proprietary software that you use in the assistance of acquiring your multifamily units. Could you talk to what that is?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's obviously proprietary, so you can't give us all your secrets, but
that's right. That's right. If I really told you, what has to happen, but obviously I'm not sitting directly next to you, so that can't happen. But I started way back when in the foreclosure business, before there was such a thing as websites to give you information on foreclosures. So I saw that all my competitors at the auction were keeping track of foreclosures using manila envelopes and paper, and they're always shuffling through. And I realized there had to be a better way, so I developed software that allowed me to track all the foreclosure sales in our area, and you know, and automatically calculate you know, some information for us that helped us in a lot of different ways. And it really gave us a tremendous advantage, and we were able to leverage that for a number of years, and still do to this day. I think we've been using it now for almost 20 years. Now there's internet sites that give some information, but I just don't rely on it. We do everything in-house. I think it's still a better way. So we got into multifamily, you know, recognizing how valuable that tool was. I realized I needed to do the same thing on the multifamily side to allow me to underwrite income streams you know, figure out the right price to pay and calculate the returns to the investors and forecast everything on a really conservative basis. And so we developed our own in-house software that analyzes this income for us and allows us to forecast pretty darn well, as history has shown, what we can do on an income property.
Yeah, awesome. You know, everyone needs some sort of, you know, calculator, spreadsheet when they're analyzing deals, whether it be fairly rudimentary or very advanced like yours. But, you know, everybody does need some kind of tool to help them out in analyzing properties to, you know, kind of build that funnel and make it more efficient. So
you got to have some. And there's some that are commercially available that you can buy, you know, and I just realized that I wanted something that was very specific to us and we could completely customize for the way that we do business. And, you know, as a result, I've spent thousands of hours in development and probably as much time developing software tools as I have on the real estate side. But it gives us a tremendous advantage over just acquiring off-the-shelf products.
Yeah, good. So Brian, when you're going into new markets and looking for acquisitions in different cities and states, what kind of trends are you looking at as far as demographics, local economies, things like that?
That's a great question, because really it all starts there. You know, real estate is very local, and people ask me all the time, you know, what do you think about the real estate market? And my response is always like, is there such a thing as the real estate market?
Yeah.
If there is, I haven't
found
it yet.
Super hot.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, you know, it's real estate markets are different everywhere. So the first thing, you know, I always say that, you know, the real estate agents always tell you location, 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 right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say that that's way outdated. The three rules of real estate now, it's timing, strategy, and location. So location still plays a role, and it probably plays the first role. So when you're thinking of a location, I'm not thinking of, you know, the corner of Main and Main. That's not how I think of location. I think of location as being where in the country or where in the world would you want to invest in real estate, because you're swimming with the current, as opposed to trying to go upstream. So the first thing we're doing is we're looking for an area where the economic fundamentals that support multifamily are in our favor. And, you know, what we found right now is, you know, we found Central Florida, Atlanta, Phoenix, you know, Vegas to an extent, Texas, Carolinas, you know, Research Triangle area. You know, there's specific areas of the country where the economy is really doing well in a way that supports multifamily investment. And so that's the first thing we're looking for, is let's find that area. And once we've found the area, then we start drilling down to timing and strategy. You know, is it the right time to invest in this area? And what's the strategy? Is the strategy to get in and get out quickly because we're going to capture a quick lift? Or is the strategy to buy and hold because we're going to ride a long-term wave? You know, what is the strategy that works right now? So, we're looking to implement the right strategy in the right place at the right time. And so we kind of have to find a confluence of all three of those in order to make it work.
Man, that's fantastic. I think you hit it right on the head there. So when you're looking at these markets that you like, the Carolinas, Central Florida, Arizona, are there any common denominators of those? Is it job growth? Is it migration trends? Are there local laws that you like? You know, what is it that exactly you're looking for?
Well, the local laws part is, you know, one good reason to stay out of California. Once you get outside of California, then, you know, I think we're fine. We do find that the best indicators for multifamily investment is job growth, population growth, and the affordability of the rent to median income ratios. So, you know, we're looking at areas where you can buy or you can find, you know, robust job growth, household formation, population in migration, yet, you know, the tenants on average are paying, you know, 20 to 30% of their income in rent versus 46% or something like they are in Southern California.
Yeah, right. Do you have any resources that you like using for these kind of data analysis?
One of my favorites is the Milken Institute's Best Performing Cities Index. They put it out every year in December or January, and it ranks 200 metropolitan statistical areas in terms of how well they're performing, and it uses weighted scores based upon those fundamentals that are really important to multifamily. So that's a really great source. And a couple things I look for, you know, what are the top markets? And also which markets are moving the most spots over the previous year. And that kind of gives you some ability to identify trends and, you know, kind of the movers so you can get ahead of what's going to be a great market before everybody else gets word of it. So that's a good one. The Urban Land Institute puts out a report every year, and it's an interesting report on real estate trends throughout the country. So that's another good one. And then just aside from that, it's just a lot of reading articles and trying to get familiar with what's going on in the country and, you know, where factories are moving to or whatever, where the jobs are going, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So just kind of reading between the lines of, you know, different information you find valuable.
That's right.
You have to really be careful about the sources you look into as well. I mean, say you're looking into Texas and you look at the Texas Association of Realtors, I'm sure they're going to be pretty bullish on, you know, the local Texas markets, right? So you have to kind of consider where you're getting your source of information from.
Well, anybody that's trying to sell you something is automatically disqualified as an expert.
I like that. Yes, definitely true. Okay, Brian, well, wrapping up here, I'd like to ask you a few lightning round questions, but before we get that, I want to know what your reasons why are. Why are you growing this portfolio so big? Why are you doing what you're doing exactly?
Well, I do this because I like it. I enjoy real estate. I enjoy talking to investors. I enjoy performing for the investors. And I don't mean like a puppet show or, you know, dance or anything. I mean, I like producing results for them. You know, it's like, you know, we've gotten some incredible feedback from some of our investors that have just, you know, been highly complimentary. And, you know, that just, it's enjoyable to do that. I just have a lot of fun doing this. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And I'm not going to go back to work in law enforcement. You know, I've been there and done that, and I'm not going back. This is what I'm going to do until I can no longer do it.
Yeah, I guess it kind of goes with that saying, if you do what you love for work, you'll never work a day in your life, right?
That's absolutely true.
Some kind of paraphrase version of that.
That works for me. That was pretty close.
Okay. All right, Brian, well, wrapping up, we've got a lightning round, just a series of questions we'll fire at you, and you just kind of shoot from the hip. How's that sound?
Let's go for it.
Okay, great. Getting started. What was your biggest hurdle getting started in real estate investing, and how'd you overcome it?
I didn't have any money. I had no money at all when I invested in real estate. I was 20 years old. I was working in a grocery store, you know, making about $12 an hour. And I lived in California, where real estate was even expensive at that time. So that was my biggest hurdle. I overcame it initially by applying for every credit card offer that came in the mail and taking that stack of credit cards down to the bank and saying, cash advance every one of these to the limit, and looking at their crazy look on the banker's face when they're like, are you sure you want to do that? And I went out and bought real estate with it and never looked back. But the way I really overcame the problem was by getting investors. And I was able to get people to invest in my deals because I could show, using those deals that I bought with my credit cards, which, by the way, I don't recommend everybody go and does this. It's a very risky strategy. But that's how I built a track record, that I could show to investors and say, look at what I've done. Would you invest in it? And they did. And, you know, since that time, we've raised probably close to, or actually over $50 million and probably close to about $75 million before this year is out from investors. And it all started with that first credit card offer that came in the mail.
Great. Okay. Do you have a personal habit that contributes to your success?
Yeah, I'm just committed to this business. I get up every morning and come to the office and go through it. You know, we're looking for property. You know, we have a goal to underwrite one multifamily deal a day, and we just crank through the work and we get it done. So my personal habit is to be here, be accessible, be responsive, do what I say I can do. Do what I say I will do, and I think that's been the key to our success.
Awesome. I think that's great. Okay, do you have an online resource that you find valuable? I know we talked a little bit about some indexes and the Urban Land Institute, but anything else?
Yeah, I think those are great sources. I think by far the best real estate resource on the internet is biggerpockets.com. I signed up on that website on a whim a few years ago just to give back and, you know, answer questions on this online forum. And, you know, as a result of having done so, I was invited to be on their podcast three separate times. I'm only one of two people, I think, that have done, or three people that have done that. And just gotten some incredible relationships that have developed from my participation on that website. So whether you're looking for advice on a deal, or you're looking to network, or you're looking to meet people, or you're looking to have people become aware of what you're doing, all of those things seem to come together on that website, and it's been an incredible resource.
Yeah, you're right. It's a phenomenal resource. You and I are both on there. Everybody's on there. There's just a plethora of information for people from beginners to experts and everywhere in between. So you got to get on there if you're not already there.
Absolutely.
Okay. What book would you recommend to the listeners and why?
Gosh, great question. You know, it's funny. I read this book like, I think 3 or 4 years ago called Real Leaders Don't Do PowerPoint. And I don't know why that book still sticks in my mind, even after all this time, because it's not one that you hear on, you know, everybody on these podcasts always says, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and, you know, and The Art of the Deal. I mean, you know, those are phenomenal books,
phenomenal books.
But this one is an off the wall one that talks about, you know, giving presentations, and you don't just sit there and flash slides in people's faces and read bullet points. I mean, when you're going to present something to someone, you've got to tell the story and engage your audience. And that's what this business is all about, especially if you're raising money. It's all about engaging your audience and delivering a message. And you just can't do that if you're boring people to death by reading bullet points off of a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah, that's a great point. Let's get off track real quick. And I guess that could also be related to when you're pitching deals to investors. You know, you're often doing that over email, via the phone, so it makes it a little not so personal. How have you taken your skills from that book and been able to relay them into that kind of workflow?
Well, I hired a guy to do that.
right.
So, you know, well, it's funny. You know, I used to pitch to investors, but we don't anymore. I mean, you know, now people come to us and they say, I've heard about what you guys are doing, or I know somebody that's investing with you, and I want to be a part of it. And so we don't have to sell anymore. I mean, all we do now is we just talk about what we do. And so there's nothing easier than telling your story or talking about what we do. You know, for example, you invited me to be on this podcast. I didn't have to take any notes or jot down, you know, answers to potential questions, because you're going to ask me about my story, and it's very easy to tell us, you know, your own personal experience. So when you're pitching to investors, the most important thing for you to do is to tell your story and tell the investor what it is that you're doing and why you're doing it and what you've done and how you got there. And if you can get through that, and you can always get through that without a PowerPoint presentation, if you can get through that and establish that connection with that investor where they trust you, because that's what this is. This isn't all about what people say, oh, you find a great deal, the investor will invest it because it's a great deal and they're going to love it, it's a great deal. No, that is not true. The investors will invest in your deal because they trust you that you're going to do what the business plan says you're going to do and that you're going to give them their money back. So that's the message that you have to convey, and you can only convey that message in human to human contact. So you've got to get on the phone with your investors. One thing that we always do here when we get a new investor that, you know, emails and says, "Oh, I saw your podcast or heard your podcast, or we saw you on Bigger Pockets or whatever, and you know, I'm interested in investing with Praxis." The first thing we always do is we schedule a phone call with that investor to ask about them and listen to their story and learn their goals, so that we can determine whether or not we're even a fit for them. And you know, without that human connection, you don't raise money. So this is still a person-to-person business, despite all the advances in internet and online and crowdfunding and all that other stuff.
What a great piece of advice. That's awesome. All right, so our very last question, if you were to give advice to your 20-year-old self to get started in real estate investing, what would it be?
Oh, geez.
You know, I ask this question to everybody and every time it's your 20-year-old self, but in your case, you actually were 20 years old doing this. So
I was, but that doesn't make the question any less relevant, because, no. You know, even if you started when you're 20, it doesn't mean you did it right. It just means you started. So, you know, if I had to go back to my 20-year-old self, I would have so many lessons to impart upon how not to screw this up, because I don't care how smart you are or how many people you know that are doing real estate. When you start investing in real estate on your own, you're going to mess some stuff up. I don't care how many books you've read. You know, it just doesn't matter. You're going to mess stuff up. And I call it the rookie mistake phase of your career. And so, you know, when people ask about investing with Praxis and that sort of thing, you know, or as an alternative to investing with, you know, so-and-so that's a new syndicator or whatever, you know, I always tell people, you want to avoid being in the experimental phase or the rookie mistake phase of someone's career on your dime. So, you know, I would tell my 20-year-old self all the lessons that I've learned and how to do real estate right and not screw it up. Because as small as those mistakes may be, and maybe you come out in the end and everything turns out fine, they always cost you something, whether it's time, whether it's money, whether it's reputation, whatever the case may be. Avoiding those mistakes is so invaluable. And if I could have taught myself how to avoid every mistake, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. I'd be retired.
Well, great. I think that's a really good advice. All right, Brian, well, wrapping up here, is there anything you'd like to leave with our audience? Any last parting advice, guidance?
I would say if you're not investing in real estate now, it's a great vehicle if you love real estate. If you don't like it, don't do it. Go find something else. But if you're already investing in real estate, you can grow your business if that's what you want to do. You just have to be absolutely dedicated. You have to put one foot in front of the other. There are no shortcuts. This is not a get-rich-quick business. This takes time. It's taken me 20 years to get here. And when I was 20 years old, I thought I'd get here in like 3 years. So it just doesn't work that way. So be patient, but do something to further your goal every single day, and you will ultimately get there.
Awesome. Thanks for that. All right, Brian, where can our guest contact you for more information?
The best way to find me is through our website. If you go to praxcap.com, which is praxcap.com, it's short for Praxis Capital. You can go to that website. There's information on the site about what we do and case studies about deals we've done and, you know, how we've brought the rents from here to here by fixing it up like this, and pictures and videos and all kinds of stuff. So you can kind of get an idea of what it is that we do and how we do it. That's the best place to start. And then, you know, if you want to talk to us further, then you can give Bob Dreher a call here in our office and get a conversation started. And, you know, we'd love to have an opportunity to have you come visit us here in our office.
Awesome. So that's praxcap.com, short for Praxis Capital. We'll link that in the show notes.
Great.
All right, Brian. Well, we certainly appreciate your time today. It was great visiting with you, and we look forward to talking with you next time.
Sounds great, Jacob. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
You too.
All right. That wraps up our episode today with Brian Burke. We touched on several different topics, from not trading your time for dollars at a day job to the difficulties in scaling to large magnitudes, flipping 100 houses a year. We touched on the differences in raising money through funds versus raising money for each individual deal, buying foreclosure properties, and the difficulties of doing 1031 exchanges with multiple owners. Brian gave some great resources for studying demographics and economies of real estate markets. Overall, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're getting value out of this show, please let me know by leaving a rating and review. It would mean a lot and really help the show out. So please, if you haven't yet, go over to whatever platform you're listening on and leave a rating and review. If you have any questions or comments or want to hear something specific, just let me know. Please email me at info@jacobayers.com, contact me at www.jacobayers.com, or connect with me on Facebook at The Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom. Till next week, signing off, I'm your host, Jacob Ayers.
You've been listening to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast, providing you actionable content to build your real estate empire. Nothing on this show should be considered specific, personal, or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, financial, or business professional for personal advice. The opinions of guests are their own. Information is not guaranteed. All investment strategies have a potential for profit or loss. The host is operating on behalf of the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom, LLC, exclusively.